Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 18th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Gardening Today. We welcome Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum, Bob Graves of Fatigan's Nursery, and Dale Isla Riggs of the Berry Patch in Steventown, New York, to take your gardening questions. If you have one, call 800-348-2551. Do it soon. It gets pretty crowded. 800-348-2551 is the number, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Several people have already done that, but you can give it a shot as well. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Gardening Today. Fred, Dale Isla, and Bob coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's gardening once again today. We welcome back an all-star team to answer your questions. Bob Graves is co-owner of Fatigan's Nursery in Latham, New York. Fred Breglia is the director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. And Dale Isla Riggs is the owner and operator of the Berry Patch, a first-generation diversified farm in Steventown, New York. You got a gardening question? We have experts. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. Again, our number and the phone lines, there's a couple open lines. Soon enough, there'll be none. 800-348-2551. And let's get the show on the road. Fred, Bob, Dale Isla, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you all here in a very cool Studio A, and it smells wonderful in here, and we'll get to the reason why in a moment. Before we do that, we'll go to less fragrant gifts brought by Fred Breglia. You got the potatoes again.
We got the potatoes again, right? Yeah, we harvested those yesterday. My son Mikey helped me, and I like to just take a minute and say, build soil, and you can really get good results. And we've been spending a lot of time building the soil at our garden, and with a lot of good compost, and we also surface mulch with straw, shredded straw. And this year, as everyone probably knows, it's been unbelievably dry. One of the driest years I've had in a while.
Yep.
And at our house, we don't have a lot of excess water to be given plants. So this year, I grew a lot of garlic, huge bulbs, no water, no fertilizer. And these potatoes here you're looking at, these are called banana potatoes because of the look of them.
Yeah.
And that's full-sized. So that's, you know, what they grow to genetically. And they're a cold hardy source. They came from Maine. And they just do really good. And this year with those guys, no water, no fertilizer, prolific potatoes. That was all off of, this is not even all of it, all off of one plant.
That is incredible.
One hill that we mounded up. So, you're
talking about preparing the soil, but it's super important for the root crops. Right?
It is.
Potatoes and beets and radishes and carrots. Try to grow those in hard ground. It doesn't work well.
It doesn't work well. And, you know, the other benefit is that with those organics in there, you're really going to retain whatever little moisture that we do get.
Right.
And when we dug them up, you know, I got to say, even all this drought, when you got down to the bottom of those where those potatoes were, it was actually, it was moist soil.
That's amazing.
The soil was big clods, and when you squeeze them, they just sort of break apart. And it's just a testament to, you know, if you prepare it, it takes a while, and it's not going to say it's easy, but it really does have really good results. So enjoy, my friend.
Oh, my gosh. Last year you brought some of the
same exact potatoes.
We fried them up with onions, and it was a huge, massive hit. So this is exciting stuff.
Great.
Now,
enjoy.
The reason Studio A is so fragrant today is because Dale Isla Riggs brought some more stuff than I usually see on a Food Friday. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it's melon mania time right now at the Berry Patch.
I love it.
We grow 9 or 10 different varieties of melons, some of which are cantaloupe types and several are not. So I thought it might be kind of fun for people to hear us talk about them.
Hear us eat them.
Right.
People don't like that.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So we've got two different types of cantaloupe here. One is sugar cube, which is a really small little.
This guy over here?
Yep. It's actually considered to be a personal size cantaloupe. That's what the seed companies call it.
About the size of
it.
A softball.
Though. Exactly.
Cantaloupe,
or a little bit smaller.
Pass them around.
And it's well named. There's Sugar Cube, and then it's got a big sister called Sugar Rush, which is a little bit bigger.
Oh, yeah? What about Sugar Coma? Is there one of those?
Well, when I had Sugar Rush last week, I felt like I could wind up in a coma, that's for sure. It was super sweet and super delicious. Wow. And then we've got the next size up that's called Aphrodite, which is a more of a standard size, larger cantaloupe, but also...
This one?
That's what this one
is.
Wow,
that's quite impressive.
Yeah. So, and then the one with kind of the striations on it, with the sutures on it.
It's like a football. Ready?
It is.
There it is.
It's got nice heavy netting and easy to throw.
I'm not going to throw this at Bob Graves at the moment, but...
You can get a nice spiral on it,
right,
though, because
exactly.
It has those grooves.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's actually called a Tuscan melon, and it tastes like cantaloupe, but it's got a firmer texture. So think prosciutto and melon.
Oh,
they're really nice for that. Tuscan melon from Tuscany.
Mm. Did you bring the prosciutto?
I didn't have time.
So All right, fair enough. You know what? Beggars can't be choosers. That's and frankly, this looks delightful.
Right.
Bon appetit, though. This is great.
Yeah, good
real
stuff.
Tasty. Yeah, that's sweet. You can see why they call it Sugar Rush.
That's right.
We will be passing those around here in Studio A as we go along. The number here is 800-348-2551. Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum, Dale Isler Riggs from the Berry Patch, and Bob Graves from Fadigan's Nursery are here to answer your questions. And so many questions already. This email from Mary in Rensselaerville. Can any of the experts shed light on why there seem to be more deer in our town of Rensselaerville this year and much earlier than usual? Why are they eating all plants and vegetables, including those that the deer typically avoid? I have a 6-foot fence around my vegetable garden, regularly spray a commercially available deer repellent product that typically works, but not this year. Will the deer remember my delicious garden and come back next year? Or is there some good news here for me that deer do not have great memories and will not necessarily return next year to decimate my gardens and break my heart? It's sad. You know, Mary.
I think they have good memories.
They teach their youngsters.
They also are opportunistic. So, you know, if the grass, the turf is really, really dry and it's not green, their normal feed might be reduced, and you know, your yard might, especially if you're irrigating, might start to look a lot better. So it may not be necessarily more. It might be that they're coming around more because the food source might be less.
There may be more of them too, because it has to do with the severity of the winter.
That's true.
If the winters, I've seen a lot of twins this year.
That's true.
The does have had twins.
And then a lot of times there's not as many predators. And, you know, predators are, you know, to me, it's a balanced ecosystem. You need both in place.
What deer really like is where fields have gone back to becoming brush.
Yep.
That's what they really like. Is that sort of, and we're doing a lot of that. A lot of fields are reverting back to brush.
Yeah, so they're getting more habitat.
And they're
and,
so accustomed.
More food source and, you know, typically milder winters.
They don't care about the dog.
They don't care about much of anything.
They don't care about a 6-foot fence. It's got to be more than 6 foot. They're
gonna
go right
over
8 to 10 foot.
And at least in my neighborhood, people, they love them. Yeah. Hey, how you doing?
You go out in the backyard on the deck and bag a pan, and they say, what?
All right, this is from Jan. My azaleas and rhododendrons bloomed in May. Now they are looking pretty leggy, barren, and quite frankly a bit pathetic with shriveled and dried leaves. I know I can do an aggressive pruning on them, but is it safe to prune now, or do I need to wait until winter? That's from Jan.
Yeah, so neither time are really the ideal time to prune. The time to prune them is going to be right after they flower, and that's because they set up flower buds for the following year right after they bloom. So if you did prune them now, you know, you'd be taking away next year's flowers. And the reason why they just look, you know, sort of leggy or, you know, droopy or spindly, not as full, it's a water issue. I mean, you look around the Landis Arboretum and, you know, all the grass, all the turf is all brown. And we've got a lot of the trees you're seeing early fall color. You're seeing a lot of yellowing. And, you know, rhododendrons are broadleaf evergreens. They like it a little bit more. They like that moisture and humidity, and they just don't have it.
I would deep water them now. You know, they're not going to look a whole lot better this year.
No, but you'd be...
But it'll make a difference for next year.
Now, remember, there are water restrictions popping up now. More
places?
Well, I believe the weir, but Ulster County has them now.
If you're doing deep watering, you're putting a hose out there at a trickle, or a soaker hose. You're not using a sprinkler, pushing it up in the air. It doesn't take that much water.
That's right. It's a fraction of the water that you would put on, like, your turf grass, fraction of the water. And you know, deep thorough waterings that are about once a week are a lot better than more frequent light waterings. It encourages deeper root growth, and roots are opportunistic, so you want to encourage those roots to go deep, just like when we dug up those potatoes. The top layer of the soil is real dry, so if you're doing a lot of irrigation and it's only getting down 3 or 4 inches, that's where your roots are. Drought hits, things get really stressed.
Basically, deep we tell watering. People, if you're standing there with a hose, you're not going to give it enough water.
You're not. Right. You got to stay there for a while.
Put something on there that's going to go for a few hours very slowly.
Yep. You could even punch a small hole in like a 5-gallon pail.
And let it run out.
And it'll run out real slow. Yep. They do make tree gaiters. They're like bags that sort of wrap around these shrubs or trees, and you fill them up real fast, but at 5 gallons, and then it puts that 5 gallons out real slow, and it gets down to where it needs it. None of it runs off.
And now's an important time to do that, because late August, early September is when plants start sending their carbohydrates from their leaves down to the roots to make it through the winter.
Yeah.
So now is really, if you're going to do deep watering, do it now. Don't
Absolutely.
Wait.
Well, we have to take a break here, but just quickly, in Albany anyway, or around here, we had probably the most significant rain we've had in quite some time. I think it was about 3/4 of an inch. But we watched it out from the patio, and it was a slow, steady rain. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
That's a lot better than a fast rain where you're going to get the runoff, because it's going to want to run off to a degree because it's so dry. So it takes a bit of saturation to get it to start to go down. So that slow, drizzly rain is definitely the rain you want.
You know, you can almost hear the plants saying thank you. It's incredible. And I'm like, don't thank me. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Gardening Today with Fred, Dale Island, Bob, and we are just beginning. We'll be back. Son of Mr. Green Jeans. That's good timing. Frank Zappa here as our bumper music. 800-348-2551 is the number to call on this gardening show. And Dale Isla Riggs, I had a Tuscan while we were talking. That is tremendous. That's an orange melon, right?
Yep.
And then I just had during the break the canary, which is almost it's a very light yellow, or my eyesight, my color perception is not too good. It looks light green to me.
Yeah, I call it a creamy white to light green.
Yeah.
The skin itself of the melon is yellow, canary. One of the varieties is actually named Tweety. Think about canary.
Right.
And people are like, what's it taste like? And I say, it's just got its own sweet deliciousness.
And it's such a contrast from the Tuscan. That was the first one I had, and spectacular. I think canary's even sweeter.
Yes, absolutely. And the Christmas melon is kind of like a canary, but a little bit of a hint of tropical. Yep, it's also called a piel de sapo melon, which in Spanish means frog skin, and that's what the skin kind of looks like.
It does look like a frog skin.
But it's also called Christmas melon because in Spain, where they're from, they harvest them in October to eat as a special treat on Christmas Day. It's a really long storage melon, and it just gets sweeter and sweeter
and sweeter. It holds up that long.
That's good storage
melon.
And now, do you grow all these at the Berry Patch?
Yes, we do.
Oh, my God.
Yep. As well as the Sensation melon, which is a new type of melon. Very few people in the country are growing them. And that really has what I would consider a tropical flavor, with a little bit of kind of banana, hint of banana in the background.
Notes of banana. All right, I'll try that one next. This email from Betty, and then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551. I live in Western Massachusetts. I'm wondering if it's too late to plant beets. I'm harvesting some beets now and loving them. Harvard beets with dinner last night. So I'd like to start more. I'd be putting seeds in the ground. And that's from Betty.
Planting beets at this time of year would be fine. Don't expect them to get to be 3 and 4 inches big, but they'll be nice baby beets. This is really a very important time to do fall seeding for a lot of the different winter and fall crops. So spinach, beets, we're seeding kale and collards and spinach and arugula and mesclun mix and all those kind of cool season things. Late August, early September is the perfect time to do it for a late fall harvest so you can have fresh beets for Thanksgiving.
All right, let's go to the phones here. 800-348-2551 is the number. Randy is in Woodstock. Randy, you're on.
Hi. My wife and I have a home with a big, about 6 acres of woods, sort of as it goes lawn. We don't do a lot with it. But the previous homeowner, 20 years ago, planted ferns, and we have two huge patches. Or actually, I should say we have one, because 2 days ago, a contractor who was doing some trenching for a propane line decided that when he filled in the earth, filled in the trench later, he covered one of the stands of ferns a foot deep with earth. And we're kind of heartbroken. He has his reasons for doing it. But what we want to know is there any chance that those ferns next year can grow out again through a foot of earth? And if not, what's the best way to replant such a large patch? I mean, it's like a dozen by a dozen yards, probably.
Yeah, you know, a foot is excessive. They're going to have a hard time pushing through 1 foot of soil. Now, if it's really loose soil like sand, yeah, better shot at it. Yeah, no, that doesn't sound good. So, you know, maybe, I don't know if there's any chance of getting some of that off of there.
He doesn't seem to think so. He's not enthusiastic.
No.
Wow.
I think I'd be.
We didn't give him good direction. He had to run his dozer, his little tiny bobcat dozer, over that area of the ferns because there was an outbuilding right near there. And we said, yes, you can go over it because we know they would regrow if they were just a bit torn up. But he did not consult us on putting dirt on top, and he's not amenable to removing it. So we're faced with replanting. Is there a good way to do that?
If you could salvage any of the ferns, you know.
Well, he's got another big patch, he said, too.
Yeah, he's got an even bigger patch to the
transplant
left.
Transplant out of that patch.
I would start thinking about transplanting. Yeah. You know they like the site, they should be able to acclimate pretty quickly to the new site. And as time goes on, I think you'd be, you know, looking to do a restoration like that.
What do you think, fall or spring for that?
Yeah, I think fall or spring would probably
either
work.
Either way, wouldn't do it now.
No, you wouldn't do it now. Yeah. No, not when they're actively growing, when the ferns are actively.
Well, it's also so dry where we are.
I wouldn't do it now. I think, you know, when they're dormant, they tend to do better.
October or early April, something like that.
Yeah. October or early April. And is there a good technique, or is it just sort of very arduously doing one by one?
It's grunt work. It's just digging them. Yep. It's just digging them.
Try to get a big, you know, they have good roots on ferns. Try to get a good root ball on them. And, yeah, it's not going to be easy, but, you know, it should work. And then once they get established, you know, space them so that, you know.
Yeah, they'll propagate themselves.
They'll propagate themselves. So, you know, you don't have to put them as dense as they were. Just get them kind of seeded in, you know, and then they'll start to do their own sort of work from there.
So a lot of work to be done. Hey, Randy, maybe you could guilt the guy who drove the bulldozer and make him do it. You know?
I don't know. He's a nice guy. There was just a miscommunication. I don't really blame him. He didn't know how valuable they were to us.
Sure.
But these are good suggestions. So
all right,
well,
thank you.
That.
Thanks for the call. Ferns are they're ancient. We've all seen the fossils with the ferns.
Absolutely.
And, do they adapt pretty well to different environments?
They like certain conditions, but when they find a spot that they like, they just take right off.
They really do. Yep. Yeah. They're sometimes, you know, people say that they're almost invasive. You know, certain
they
varieties
are.
And they
in,
can
in
be.
Certain situations. Yeah.
Yeah, so
I keep
you know,
digging them out of my garden.
Oh, I want more in my back 40.
Good.
I want to just leave them out there.
That's good.
Maybe the dinosaurs will come back.
We've introduced them to our property and, you know, plant them too. Same thing. Some of them are edible. The ostrich fern is a really good spring edible culinary delicacy. Yeah. And I'll bring you some this spring, Ray.
You know, Fred, I think that I'm going to stick away from picking things up out of the ground.
You just want the potatoes in the
onions.
You just
want the potatoes.
Potato, melon. All right. Let's go to Latham. John, you're on.
Hi. I've got some old holly bushes, and the branches are coated in black. Is there anything I should do, or Is it safe?
It's going to be what we call city mold, most likely. It's not uncommon to see it. You know, there might be some aphids that have maybe been on that plant. Aphids tend to secrete what they call honeydew. No pun intended with these melons. But the honeydew is a sweet nectar because they are feeding off the leaf. And then the sooty mold colonizes the honeydew or aphid frass. There's nothing bad. It's not going to hurt your plant. It just makes them look unsightly.
The hollies get an insect like a mealybug, too.
So it might be living off the mealybug frass.
Look on the branches above where the sooty mold is, and you're probably going to see something that's kind of white and cottony. And that's the insect that's producing the excretion, which is the honeydew, which is what the sooty mold is living on. So there's some other insect there, as Fred says, could be aphid, but it could also be one of these mealybug-like creatures.
That's right. And they're both going to kind of do the same thing. They're going to, sort of suck the juice out of your plant and secrete this frass, which is perfect for the sooty mold to grow on. If you ever wanted to control that, though, keep a good eye on your plants. You're not going to be able to do anything with it this year. And again, it doesn't hurt your plants. So that's the good news for the most part. But next year, keep a good eye. And these insects we're talking about are small. The vast majority of all insects are good. But there's a really small percentage of insects that cause plant problems. And that's a very small percentage. And most of those, although some of them are large, most of those are really small. So, when you look at your leaves, you may not see them. You might even need a hand lens. But those aphids and even the mealybugs are actually relatively easy to control with insecticidal soap. So there's no chemical needed for these. They can be smothered.
I would be doing a soap or an oil spray in the
exactly.
spring.
Exactly.
There's something there.
Yep. And then if you control that, the sooty mold can't grow. And then you'd, solve the problem.
All right, John, thank you very much for the call. Dale Allard, did you want to jump in?
I like the idea of the oil in the spring and then soap early in the spring when you start to see the aphids appearing.
They're contact killers. Those things are not dangerous in the sense that they're not a stomach poison or a nerve poison. They suffocate the insect.
That's right. It smothers it.
If you don't hit it, you don't kill it.
That's right. Yep.
The sensation, real good, Dale Allard. Tell me about that one again.
So it's a new type of melon. It's actually developed by a company in Colorado, and they're not saying what type of melons they crossed. I'm guessing that it's probably an interspecific cross, meaning between species.
Yep.
We've been growing it probably 6 or 7 years. I don't know of anyone else in the area that's growing them, but they named it really well. The first time I ate it, I thought, wow, that is super well named.
Well, I've had all four now, or I think you have four. You want to try that one? There you go, Fred. Fred, what do you think is the best? I like the Tuscany, and I love the Christmas. I'm thinking the Canary might be my favorite.
I haven't tried them all yet, so let's come back to later in the show.
All right, meanwhile,
Fred's final judgment.
All right, let's go to Rosemary in Voorheesville. Rosemary, you're on. Hello, Rosemary. I think your signal's bad. Now, you're in Voorheesville. Sometimes the signal can be rough up there. Want to try it one more time? Oh, no, you sound like a robot. I'll tell you what, if you call back, we'll get you right back on the air. Thank you very much. We'll go to Jennifer and Rhinebeck. Jennifer, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm calling about... Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay.
I'm calling about the tomato hornworm, and I want to know how I can kill them naturally.
So tomato hornworm is what we call a lepidopterous pest, and Bacillus thuringiensis is a natural microbial insecticide that will get any of the lepidopterous pests. So there's several different strains. Any good garden center would have Bacillus thuringiensis, and you can use that. And we actually hand pick them off our tomatoes and put them in 5-gallon buckets, and then...
What do you do with them then?
We put them under the tire of a car.
Really?
Yep.
You squash them.
We squash them.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah.
It seems like a humane way to get rid of them. Jennifer, do you want to follow up?
Yes, I hand-picked off a bunch of them yesterday, and we were having a fire outside, so we put them in the fire.
Nice.
But it looks like I took them all off. I don't know if I'm going to get more.
You very well will get more. I mean, they've been flying for, it's the sphinx moth. It's actually the larvae of the sphinx moth.
I love that moth.
Yeah, so the sphinx moth is a really cool moth.
It's a really cool moth.
So they are the larvae of the sphinx moth. So you probably will have some more, and you just need to keep an eye out for the frass, the droppings on the ground, and you know, they're very well camouflaged, as you well know, and though you hope that you got them all, there's probably some that you missed because they are so well camouflaged. So keep an eye out for the frass, pick them off. The other thing to look for, though, is there is a natural parasite of them. And so if you see any with little white cocoons out of the top of the hornworm, leave those because those are the native parasite, and those will kill it all on its own. And it's, some years are great, and you'll have 30, 40 cocoons sticking out of one hornworm.
Okay.
And you want those wasps to hatch out of those cocoons and then go infect more hornworms.
These are wasps that kill the hornworms.
The wasps lay their eggs in the hornworm.
Yikes.
And yeah, it's kind of alien-like.
Yeah.
and they do a number on the hornworm and then create these. You're actually seeing the pupae in the cocoons on top of the hornworm.
Well, Jennifer, good luck with that one. 800-348-2551, the telephone number. Yep, it's the gardening show today with Dale Isla Riggs, Bob Graves, and Fred Breglia. We go to lovely Scotia. Cindy, you're on.
Hello. I'm hoping you can help me with a very overgrown forsythia bush. It is easily 45 years old, probably more than 50. It is more than 12 feet tall, and I'm having a terrible time keeping it well pruned and taken care of. How far down can I cut it in the fall? I know I will not get flowers, but how can, so it won't die?
Yeah, so generally, you know, 30%, 25 to 30% total volume off at any one pruning session is what we recommend. And, you know, going beyond that creates additional stress. Now, the ideal time to prune that would be in the spring right after it blooms, and then you would, you know, maximize the flower set. If you prune it in the fall, you're going to take away, of course, the flowers on the parts of the plant that you're pruning. Right. But it is ideal. Its ideal timing is spring right after bloom.
But if
and,
she, if
25,
she,
30%.
If she prunes it now, all she loses is the bloom. She's not really going to hurt the plant.
Yeah, probably not excessively. I mean, no. This is really dry right now, so, you know, I wouldn't prune it any, you know, too much pruning in the middle of this drought, just because plants are going to then start to try to allocate their resources to fixing injuries. And every time you do a pruning cut, even if you're, you know, the best of the best, you're it's an injury on a plant. It's not like a pruning cut's not. So, you know, and as we mentioned before, this time of year, the plants are really storing for winter. So they want those resources, and we don't have enough water as it is. So resources are limited. So
she could wait at this point.
Yeah, I would wait.
You know, September, October, or something like that. Now, the other thing we do.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
When we trim forsythias, we go in as low as we can to take out the old growth, the oldest growth, because it will rejuvenate itself. It will push out new growth. So before you even start to take it down, take some of that old gnarly stuff out of there first so you don't have to waste time trimming that.
And that's good, too, because it actually lets a little bit more air and light in there.
Light.
And then you actually end up, because of air and light, especially the light, you actually get more interior foliage instead of just a dense exterior foliage. And in times of drought, since this is really, you know, one of the biggest droughts I've seen in 25 years, Atlantis, at least the longest, I would say that, you know, having interior foliage, when it's really dry and really hot, the plant will actually, water movement's driven through transpiration. That's what drives it up through the tree, and it loses it out of the leaves. And when it's really, really hot, the plants will actually shut off those exterior leaves, the ones that are on the outside of the plant, and those interior ones become really important. So introducing light to the inside of your plant is going to give you more interior foliage and a healthier overall plant.
All right, Cindy, thank you very much. Go ahead, Dale Allen.
I was just going to ask these guys, you know, a lot of times we wait until like Thanksgiving to do the pruning of some things, and I'm wondering if she might want to actually wait that long.
Depending upon what it is,
it's all different. Yeah.
It would be fine. Yeah. The idea for trimming things after they flower is so you're not taking the flower buds off for the next year. But sometimes you want to prune something. You don't care whether you get flowers the next year. It doesn't mean you'll never get flowers again.
No. But the other thing to consider is that when they're actively growing after they bloom, you're going to get more blooms. But not only that, the plants actually got a lot of vigor, and all these injuries, trees don't heal injuries. Sure. Plants don't heal injuries. They seal or they don't. Mm. And during that time of year, they're going to have a much easier time to close over those injuries, so you're going to get less rot and less problems.
Yeah, the ideal time to prune something is when it's in a period of growth, but not most active growth.
That's
so
right.
So it does have energy to heal.
That's right. The two times that Dr. Alex Shigo, they call him the father of modern arboriculture, said to never prune is when the leaves are actively flushing out at their peak in the spring, or when they're actively falling off in their peak in the fall. That's a sort of peak physiological times for the plant, and pruning, you know, and fixing injuries is not ideal during that time.
Let's take a quick break here. It's Gardening, 800-348-2551, the number. Fred Breglia, Dale Isler Riggs, and Bob Graves, and the home stretch coming up. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It's Gardening Today with Dale Isler Riggs, Bob Graves, and Fred Breglia. And the lines are loaded. If you hear somebody hang up, give it a try. You know, I don't even know if we'll get to all of these before we're done, but we'll give it a shot. Let's go to Utica. And Judy, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Ray and everyone. Hi. I have two questions about my hydrangea. There's been a lot of talk about pruning, but I'm wondering if the same applies to my hydrangea. Should I wait now after hearing the other responses? Should I wait until after a frost maybe to cut it back?
Depends.
And if so, how far? It's 1 year old.
Depends on what type of hydrangea. What type of hydrangea is it? Do you know?
I don't know.
What color are the flowers?
What color, Judy?
Well, they're white. And a little teeny bit of pink on some of the petals on the outer side.
Sounds like it's growing. It's in the sun. It's growing.
Yes, sun.
Yeah. I think that's probably
it's the first year.
It's probably a panicle type or a hydrangea paniculata, and they're very tolerant.
Okay.
What we normally do with those is wait until the blooms sort of deteriorate in the fall and trim them back a little bit at that time. You can really, I hate to say this, but you can butcher these, and they'll come back and look fantastic.
Oh.
But you don't have to.
I mean,
you trim it a little bit. I would wait. Again, we were talking about you don't want to necessarily do it right now because you're going to lose your flowers. But shortly after the flowers,
after a frost or before a frost, would you recommend?
It's hard to say because we never know when we're going to get a frost anymore.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
true.
What do you think, Fred?
It's hard to say in terms of the frost. You know, it's unpredictable. It used to be, predictable nowadays because you have
gonna,
this like really crazy variations with weather, and we're seeing those swings.
You're really
happen
not going to hurt
more.
This one.
So
right.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's going to
tolerant.
If it's that type, you're it's very tolerant.
Yeah.
So
I do cover it in the winter. I put a shelter over it so it doesn't get all killed by the ice and snow and
sure.
so forth.
Sure. Yep.
So I could take it back to a few inches from the ground then, you think, maybe?
Oh, I don't think you need to do that. No, I mean, as we usually say, 25-30%. Take the flowers off, maybe a little below that.
Oh, okay.
But not down to the ground, no.
And my second question is, someone once, I don't know if they were correct or if I imagined it, but I thought somebody said you have to put a particular sort of additive, an acid, in the soil to make it turn color.
You know, that's only certain.
True or?
It is true for certain types of hydrangea, and if you acidify the soil with those types, they turn blue.
I don't think that's what you have.
It's not what you have.
If it's a paniculata type, you can't change the color.
No, because it would be either bluish or it'd be real pinkish. And if you alkalize those other varieties, they'll be more sweet. Another alkalize, as in sweeten the soil, raise the pH. They'll tend to be more pink, and you drop the pH, they tend to be more blue. But like Bob said, it doesn't sound like that's the variety you have. So it in your case, a balanced fertilizer would be probably, it sounds like it's doing well. And a balanced fertilizer, applied, late fall or early spring would would be what
we
would
recommend. The type that change color are macrophyllas.
That's right.
Macrophylla hydrangeas.
Well, Judy, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it very much. This email, perfect in your wheelhouse, Dalila, from Rebecca. I have a large, productive raspberry patch. All the berries that look ripe and ready to be picked have small holes in the bottom of the berry. They've been sucked dry, leaving the berry with a hole in it, and the berry dried out. Do you know what's doing this? We've never had this problem before, and that's from Rebecca.
I suspect that it might be something like Japanese beetle that is feeding on them or some of the other insects. That it has been so dry, things are going after fruit for moisture. So I think... You know, I've not seen that, but our raspberries are in an enclosed tunnel. But I think Japanese beetle or some similar type.
Last time you were here, you were talking about the insect that goes after the blueberries. Is that something that goes after raspberries, too?
So the favorite host of spotted wing Drosophila, which is what I was talking about before, is raspberries. That will not cause a hole.
Not that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You've got something feeding on those, and I suspect that it's for moisture and for the sweetness.
Mm. Sure. If it was in the raspberry, how would you spot that? What would it cause on the raspberry?
Spotted wing Drosophila?
Yeah, what would that cause on the raspberry?
The raspberries will kind of turn into soup on the plant. And if you catch it early, when you take the raspberry off the receptacle, the little cup that it's on, and you look inside and there's a little droplet of juice, you've got spotted wing Drosophila in there.
Okay.
Spotted wing has not been as much of an issue this year as most because it has been so hot and dry.
Right.
But populations are building. People with raspberries in September are still going to have it.
Yeah. All right, back to the phones we go here on the gardening edition of Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Erica in Saratoga. Erica, you're on.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I have some strange thing going on with my milkweed, which I planted to save the monarchs. And instead of having monarchs flying around, I have blowflies and a whole bunch of what seems to be some sort of aphid orange insect all over the stems, and then just a whole bunch of blowflies flying around and no monarchs. So can you help me out? What's going on? I feel like I just want to rip them all out because it's kind of gross.
Mm. So you think you have aphids, you say?
I don't know, some sort of aphid-like insect crawling all over the stems of the...
They're kind of clustering on the stems?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that definitely sounds like an aphid. So they're soft body insects. So what I do with those when they cluster up, and they do this with lupine, they do it with a lot of different plants, I kind of grab the stem and sort of just pull my hand up gently, and they just... kind of squash when you do that. They're so soft, they get damaged so easily. So I sort of do that first, and then I come back through and I use an insecticidal soap and I spray under the leaves and above the leaves because a lot of them are under the leaves. Mm. And that usually that 2-1-2 combo is deadly on aphids. So, it's really easy to do. And then I wouldn't take them out. Because if they're there, the monarchs are around, and it'll be more beneficial to leave them, even if they're a little unsightly. Aphids do tend to cause disfiguration, and in a real bad situation, they can kill.
The flies are probably there for the honeydew of the aphid.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah,
the flies are incidental. They're just feeding off the excretion.
Exactly. We talked about honeydews. It's sort of the theme of the show here. But that frass is what those aphids are sort of pooping out, and what the sooty molds are growing on. That's what the blowflies are going for. And you might also see a bunch of ants. And the reason why you'll see ants are because the ants actually tend to be farmers for the aphids because they actually live off of that that nectar that they're secreting. And if you actually start to, do what I told you when you squash them or sort of run your hand up the stem to remove them, sometimes the ants will actually attack you because they say, don't hurt my aphid crop. They're like little
terrifying.
Farmers. So it's a wild world out there.
Erica, thank you. Appreciate the call. Good luck. And, we had an email here. I must confess to those of you who have emailed in during the show that my email is not exactly functioning, but I can see just a couple of lines from Mary's email. Do monarchs eat and lay eggs on any kind of milkweed or a particular type?
It's the swamp milkweed, the butterfly milkweed. It'll do it also on the wild milkweed, and I do believe there's even one other variety of milkweed.
There's a fourth variety.
So it's those after. Four are your main biggies, and introducing them at the Arboretum. We put them in all the time, and we actually leave a lot of the wild milkweeds in the perennial gardens, and we do put up some signs that sort of explain that, because a lot of times people consider that a weed, and it certainly could be a weed. I mean, anything that's growing in a spot where you don't want it is the definition of a weed. But we do leave a lot of those on there. So there's three butterfly milkweed, the swamp milkweed, and the regular are their main. And there's even a fourth one. Can't think of the name of that guy.
All right, let's go try to grab some. Having some technical difficulties with both the email and my computer here, and it shows. Well, I think I know who's calling, but we'll give it a shot. We go to Esther in Schuylerville. Esther, you're on, I think.
Hi, glad to talk with you.
Hi.
I have Shasta daisies planted in flower boxes, and of course they're finished now. Can I dig them out now and plant them, and will they grow?
They should, yeah. I mean, if they're deteriorating at this point, you don't want to move them until they're really starting to go downhill. You never, as we said before, you don't move things when they're in a period of active growth. But yeah, you should be able to take those out and put them in the ground as soon as.
What's the latest time that I should plant them that they will rebloom?
Oh, I think you could do it any time in September or even into October at this point.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. I love your show. Sure.
Thanks so much for calling. Mm-hmm. And now we go to Winstead, Connecticut, I think. Glenna, you're on.
Hello there.
Hi.
Certainly enjoying your show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You had a call earlier about the hydrangea bushes, and I have very healthy hydrangea bushes come out with great leaves, but I have not had any flowers. Some of them are a few years old. Some of them are a lot of years old. They're healthy as a horse with leaves, but they never bloom.
Hmm. Yep.
And we feed them and we...
Probably a macrophylla type, and the older ones that we had years ago, and these are the ones that turn pink or blue. The older ones that we had years ago were most commonly one called Nico Blue, and I had a monster, and it never bloomed. It's not bud hardy in this area. You won't get flowers off of that plant. Now, some of the newer ones, which are like the endless summer types and the like, there's a whole lot of new ones, a lot of them, hundreds of them, and those will sometimes bloom better than others. But what we found is that heavy fertilizing in the spring makes a big difference in the amount of bloom you get on those, and usually don't trim those until the spring.
Yeah, if you wanted to try to attempt to get more blooms on those, one of the ways we recommend is to sort of shelter. What's happening is the flower buds are not as winter hardy as the foliage buds. So the leaves look fantastic because the winter temperatures don't kill them, but the flower buds are more marginal. So when it gets those cold temperatures, those flower buds get damaged and therefore no bloom. So one of the ways you can fix that is to sort of create a burlap sort of screen around them. I use some stakes that you pound into the ground, and then I get a old-fashioned burlap. And I don't put it right on the plant, but I keep it kind of close, maybe a couple of inches away from the actual foliage in a line, and wrap it around all the way to the height of that plant. And, that could certainly help. It's not a foolproof plan, but it has worked for sure. And if depending on how cold you're getting, it might just be a solution. It's worth a shot.
The old one is not going to bloom. If it's a Nico Blue, just discard it and put something else in because they're just not hard.
Really?
But the newer varieties, you can get to bloom. Yep.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Here we've got about 5 minutes or so. We go to Pine Plains. And Michelle, you're on.
Yes. Good afternoon.
Hi. You're on.
Yes. My question was about gypsy moss. I know it's not correct to call them that, but I'm from the south of France. I'm a little bit of a gypsy myself, so
all right.
I don't mind calling them that way.
What's the question?
But what is the question is, I know they come every 10 years, they say, and they came this year, of course, and they made a big bad job. Are they coming back next year, or what can we do to avoid that?
Yeah, so you're definitely going to see them. What they do is they are cyclic in cycles, like you mentioned. And the correct name is spongy moth. They've been renamed to spongy moth.
Right.
But anyways, I would expect to see gypsy or spongy moth again next season. No question about it. Now, are they going to be as bad as they are this year? What typically happens is it sort of builds up to a really bad peak, and then it sort of tapers off. And, you know, the spongy moth has been around since the 1800s. They've been trying to control it since, you know, early 19, I think actually maybe even the late 1800s when they first did control measures. But in 1915, this thing was, you know, pretty much across the country. And its origin actually, it may be native. It may not be. The origin's actually a little bit unknown as to exactly where it came from, but we do know it's very widespread. The good news about it is that there are lots of different things you can do to get rid of it. So if you see those brown egg masses that are on the trees, they favor a lot of hardwoods, oaks in particular. You'll see them on the trunks. They're like fuzzy brown egg masses. You want to make sure you're correctly identifying them because you don't want to take, you know, anything that's, you know, good off the tree. And those could be scraped off the tree, you know, with your hand and dropped into a soapy bucket. You do want to look for little holes in those little egg masses, because there is some predators, beneficial predators, that feed on them. So if you see the hole, those are things that you actually want to leave. But if you don't see any kind of holes in those fuzzy masses, they get taken off, and then in the spring, and that'll help reduce next year's population. In the spring, you can do other things to sort of deter them. There are sprays that are beneficial. They're not toxic. They're Bacillus thuringiensis, and it's a bacteria. They could be sprayed on, and it does a wonderful job of, you know, eating
them up. There are also wraps you can put around the tree to catch the caterpillars as they move up and down the tree.
That's right. And if you are using those, you want to make sure you're not putting it directly on the tree. You want to make sure you're using the right kind. Sometimes being inventive creates bigger problems. Next thing you know, you got birds tangling up in them and other things. But yeah, there are things you can do. I'll end by saying that if you do nothing, your trees are all going to be, for the most part, unless they're stressed, okay. The trees have been, you know, tolerating this pest for a long, long time. And if you look at any of the trees, you know, I went mountain biking in the summer, and it was like a heavy oak forest. It was like full sunlight without a single leaf on those trees. And when I mountain bike in those same trails now, it's full shade. They've come back and put on a full new set of leaves. So they can tolerate it, and most trees will live through it no problem. The only stressed trees get it the worst.
All right, 15 seconds here. This is from Jay. I've been using vinegar to kill crabgrass before it goes to seed. Am I vinegaring into the wind, you know, wasting my time? And that's from Jay.
Yes. You wasted your time.
That's pretty simple.
crabgrass goes to seed monumentally, and it's going to seed itself,
okay. And
you're going to have it again next year. You got to be careful with vinegar, too. There's a couple things. It acidifies the soil. And it's also, if you read the label on vinegar, it has a 48-hour reentry interval.
What does that mean?
It means you shouldn't go in that area for 48 hours.
Really?
Really.
What if you're having a salad or something with vinegar?
It's not
on
the
it?
Same type of
no?
vinegar.
It's a different vinegar. The vinegar you use to kill something is like 20% or 30%.
It is. The stuff in your salad's like 2 or 3%.
Well, I try to avoid the salads anyway. But the melons were fantastic. Dale Isla Riggs, thank you for coming today.
Glad to be here.
And for those who don't know, where is the Berry Patch?
It is on Route 22 in Steventown, New York, right beside Massachusetts.
Bob Graves, how do people find Fatigan's?
We're on 1140 Troy Schenectady Road in Latham, about 2.5 miles west of the Northway.
And Mr. Fred?
Yep. Landis Arboretum is at 174 Lape Road, Esperance, New York, and our website, landisarboretum.org.
Tremendous job, all. Support comes from the Center at Eagle Hill. Hardwick, Mass. Presents the Summer Music and Car Show, featuring live music by Lee Rocker of the Stray Cats, classic cars, food, and more. August 27th from 1 to 4, thecenteratEagleHill.org. Berkshire Mountain Distillers in Sheffield, Massachusetts, celebrating 15 years in the Berkshires with cultural cocktails, outdoor seating, and live music in summer. BerkshireMountainDistillers.com. And Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 30 years, QFCC.com. Well, a couple technical difficulties with the email here and there, little tiny glitch with the phones. But everybody, thank you for calling and for writing in. We'll do it again in 2 weeks' time, and you can try to get those questions in there. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we talk summer Italian with an Italian for all seasons, Chef Rick Orlando. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll see you for that.